and other small housing options like school bus conversions, vans, yurts, and more. Some of the homes are currently occupied by singles, couples, and even families of five. Tiny House Living Festival, featuring tiny houses on wheels and other small living options, comes to Denver, Colorado, August 11th through the 13th at Aspen Grove. Starts at 10 a.m. in the morning.
White folks can't see their own advantages. On the next edition of Alternative Radio, hear Michael Eric Dyson on white privilege. That's Alternative Radio, Wednesday evenings at 6, right here on Community Radio, KGNU, Boulder, Denver, and Fort Collins.
And it's 8 o'clock here at KGNU this Friday, August 11th. Coming up next, The Morning Magazine, now the BBC.
Hello, I'm Debbie Russ with the BBC News. President Trump has kept up his rhetoric against North Korea, warning that military solutions were, as he put it, fully in place, locked and loaded in case Pyongyang acted unwisely. In his latest tweet about North Korea's nuclear program, Mr. Trump said he hoped Kim Jong-un would find another path. The BBC's Jonathan Marcus has this analysis.
Despite efforts by his senior officials to try to tone down the sense of impending crisis with North Korea, President Trump shows no sign of declaring a ceasefire in the war of words. Only yesterday, the U.S. Defense Secretary Jim Mattis was placing the emphasis on diplomacy in handling the growing row with Pyongyang. Referring to the risk of war, he said that any conflict on the Korean Peninsula would be catastrophic. Mr. Trump's latest intervention emphasizes the inability of his administration to speak with one voice, raising questions about just what message is being heard by the North Korean regime.
Several world leaders have expressed concern about the situation, including the German Chancellor Angela Merkel.
I am fully convinced that an escalation of language will not lead to a solution to the conflict. I don't see a military solution in this conflict. I see persistent work like we saw at the UN Security Council, and above all, very close cooperation of all countries involved, especially the United States and China. But an escalation of language, in my view, is the wrong answer.
The United Nations says the Nigerian security forces have raided one of its bases, which provide aid to those affected by the Boko Haram Islamist insurgency. Many staff work and sleep at the camp in Maiduguri in the northeast of the country. The UN said it was urgently seeking answers as to why the three-hour unauthorized search was conducted. Martin Patience reports from Lagos.
The UN has a huge presence in northeast Nigeria, providing aid to those affected by the Boko Haram insurgency. But the organisation says it has no idea why one of their camps, where scores of staff worked and slept, was searched by the security forces. One possible reason was the camp's name, Red Roof. Apparently, rumours have been swirling in Maiduguri that the leader of Boko Haram is hiding out in a compound with the same name.
Kenya's election authorities have appealed for patience as they check the paperwork verifying the results of Tuesday's presidential poll from the last few constituencies. A spokesman for the Electoral Commission said it was more important to be accurate than to rush the process and make mistakes. Preliminary results show President Uhuru Kenyatta clearly ahead of the main opposition candidate, Raila Odinga. On Thursday, Mr. Odinga's supporters published their own figures, putting him ahead. You're listening to The World News from the BBC.
And welcome to The Morning Magazine, your front range morning news program here on your community radio station, KGNU. It's Friday, August 11th. Thanks for tuning in. I'm your host, Hanalee Myers. Coming up on today's Morning Magazine, we'll hear a report from the National Slam Poetry event happening in Denver this week from a Lafayette teen who has just won a national award for her work in raising awareness about the effects of gun violence in society. This week, Colorado became the 47th state to enact a felony DUI law for repeat offenders. We'll speak with attorney Jay Tiftikchin about the new law and his thoughts about how this harsher punishment may actually do little to reduce the state's problem with habitual DUI offenders. Then a Lafayette teen has just won a national award for raising awareness about the effects of gun violence in society. That's also coming up later in the program. On Tech Talks, the students at the Innovation Center in Longmont review some technology that many students will be using as they're heading back to school this year. They'll be looking at tablets. And at 8:30, we'll go to Connections with KGNU's Duncan Campbell. This morning, Duncan discusses Boulder's right to a democratic community control of its energy versus Excel. He'll be speaking with Leslie Glaustrom, Lily Franklin, and Tim Shookley. We'll be inviting you to call in and join that conversation coming up at 8:30 on Connections. But first, at 5 minutes past 8 o'clock, it's time for your local headlines. Here's Roz Brown.
Fracking will likely be coming to Boulder County by 2019. Crestone Peak Resources told the Boulder Daily Camera it is planning to develop a 12-square-mile oil field near US 287 and Colorado 52 between Longmont and Lafayette. The company will release an information package containing its plan to drill by the end of September. The proposal had been deadlocked because Crestone had asked the state to okay a standstill agreement that bars other oil companies in the area, in this case Anadarko Petroleum and Extraction Oil and Gas, from applying to drill in the same region. Anadarko and Extraction had protested the move but agreed in May and dropped their objections. The drilling is possible after Boulder County's 5-year moratorium expired earlier this year. That's when the Boulder County Commissioners conceded they would no longer fight state rules that override local wishes when it comes to oil and gas drilling. Nearby cities like Longmont and Fort Collins imposed bans on fracking only to see them shot down by the Colorado Supreme Court after spending tremendous amounts of money to challenge that. In revoking the ban, the Boulder County Commissioners enacted the state's most stringent regulations possible on oil and gas companies that submit local drilling applications. State lawmakers are working on ways to help new and young farmers in Colorado. At a hearing on Thursday, an interim committee held its first meeting and looked at possible bills that could provide financial and other assistance. Benta Berkland has more from the state capitol.
The goal is to encourage young people to farm and make it easier for them to do so. Challenges include the high cost of land and equipment, and another factor is the difficulty of transferring farms and equipment to the next generation. Nathan Weathers farms in Yuma and says with modern technology, people are retiring much later.
Most programs that are out there to benefit a young farmer, the older farmer has to die. And we struggle with that every day on our farm. You know, how does dad turn his farm over to me? I can't buy over $1 million worth of equipment from him. He's accumulated that over 40 years.
The state is considering expanding a tax credit for selling land or equipment and offering incentives for farmers and ranchers to mentor young people interested in farming. I'm Benta Berkland at the state capitol.
A Colorado lawmaker thinks it's time school students help elect local school boards. Longmont's Democratic State Representative Jonathan Singer says he plans to introduce legislation next year that would give local school boards the freedom to set the voting age as low as 16 for those elections. The current minimum voting age for federal races as well as state local races in Colorado is 18. By the halfway point of 2017, Colorado's marijuana retailers amassed more than $750 million in sales. The cannabis publication is reporting the latest tax data released by the state, which shows when medical and recreational sales are combined, they went up more than 25% in June of this year compared to the same period last year. Analysts, however, say as Colorado's marijuana industry continues to mature, the annual growth rates are expected to slow down. A lawsuit filed Thursday in U.S. District Court in Denver says a Denver police officer used excessive force when he fired a taser at a homeless man and accuses the officer and other officers in the department of preparing false police reports about just what happened. The lawsuit was filed by 53-year-old Gregory Hurd. Hurd claims Denver police officer Greg Duliev used excessive force against him, violating his Fourth Amendment rights. The city is named as a defendant in the lawsuit because the lawsuit alleges the Denver Police Department failed to train and supervise Duliev on properly using force. Hurd is asking for an unspecified amount of damages. The 2016 incident was captured on video by two activist groups, calling it an example of why the public needed to be involved in rewriting the Denver Police Department's use of force policy. A community board was convened and is still engaged in that process. There are now 11 people running for Boulder City Council this November. Matt Benjamin, Ed Byrne, Mark McIntyre, and incumbent Councilwoman Jan Burton submitted the requisite 25 signatures from registered voters this week. And they joined seven others who filed earlier: Jill Adler-Grano, Eric Budd, John Gerstle, Mirabai Nagel, former City Councilwoman Cindy Carlisle, and incumbent councilmember Sam Weaver and Mary Young. People who plan to run for Boulder City Council have until August 28th to submit paperwork. And those are your news headlines for this Friday, August 11th. The forecast for the Front Range: partly sunny today and a high of 78, low tonight of 56. Then Saturday, sunny skies in the morning and a high of 81 with rain likely in the afternoon. And the same is true for Sunday with a high of 78. Right now it's 57 degrees outside our Boulder studios. For KGNU, I'm Roz Brown.
The National Poetry Slam is taking place all week in Denver, and the competition portion of the festival began Monday night with 40 teams competing in preliminary bouts. Denver's own Slam Nuba team took on Rock Slam, Lyrical Opposition, and OM Center Poetry Slam in four rounds of word battle. KGNU's Sarah Dalgleish has more.
The room was an explosion of cheers as Denver's Slam Nuba team was announced as the winner of the first round of prelims. Each team was scored by five judges randomly selected from the audience on four poems they performed. One of those judges was Noah Kemminger of Orlando, Florida.
The hardest part is trying to be consistent throughout the entire process. So poems are such a subjective art that it's really hard to rate someone who does a comedy poem against someone who does a social justice poem. So you have to kind of like think about in your own head what your own rubrics are for judging people and be consistent with it. My rubric was I rated a little bit on performance, how well they had it memorized, and I rated a little bit on storytelling. So if someone just screamed the whole time, even if their poem was pretty cool, I took off points because they screamed it. And I rated for writing, like the quality of the writing.
I found Johnny Osai, an alternate for Slam Nuba, celebrating the win with the rest of his team. He told me what the team will have to do to qualify for finals.
Now it's on to preliminary bout two. And then if they also do well there, then there's semifinals. And if you do well there, then it's finals.
As a Denver-based poetry team, what is it like to have nationals here in your own city?
It's amazing. It's also stressful because what happens with the National Poetry Slam is the host city does a lot of work in putting it together. You know, a lot of Denver folks who haven't gotten to see what the Denver teams do in competition, you know, now they get to see it. So we get to show people our homes.
How does your team prepare for a slam like this? Do you have any practices?
Our team is selected like 3 months early, 3 or 4 months early. We start writing immediately. It's like three practices a week, starting out just writing together and trying to get poems that you can do as group pieces, duets, trios, or all five members, and then also rehearsing the individual poems. And it's like a part-time job for the summer.
Do you have any rookies on the team, or has everyone competed at a National Poetry Slam before?
Meta is a rookie this year. Meta Saramento. He just killed his first poem. He smashed it. Yeah.
Slam Nuba's tagline is "We Cut Heads." Could you explain what that's all about?
What we mean by it is we're hoping to create an experience that's so intense it will sever your head from your body.
And what are you most looking forward to this week?
People. The love. This is a big national community. This is the best part. Competition is almost a side note.
The National Poetry Slam Finals take place tomorrow in Denver, and we'll get a report on the winners and hear some of the poetry next week on The Morning Magazine. Thanks to Sarah Dalgleish for that report. On Wednesday, Colorado became the 47th state to enact felony DUI law for repeat offenders. On the line, we have criminal defense attorney Jay Tiftichin. Tiftichin has written numerous books on DUI and drug law and has been voted best DUI lawyer in Colorado by the state's official bar journal every year since 2013. Jay, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Good morning, Hannah. How are you?
Doing well. Thank you much. So to begin, explain this new felony DUI law for us.
Absolutely. It was actually 2 years ago, Colorado became the 47th state in our country to enact a felony DUI for a multiple offense. And in Colorado, what our new felony DUI law says is that if it is a fourth offense in a lifetime for DUI or DWAI, then a person faces a Class 4 felony. And that made a sentence to either prison, a halfway house, or to probation. And what had happened over the last 2 years is some judges, because of the age of priors, because of the extreme mitigation, had imposed probation, and there was either some jail time as a condition of probation, or in a very few limited cases, there was no jail time as a condition of probation. So this year, the legislature said we want to kind of tie the judge's hands, and if a person is convicted of a felony DUI, even if that person receives some sort of probationary sentence, they have to be incarcerated in the county jail for at least 90 days, and that could be up to 2 years, even if they are getting probation.
I see. Thank you for that clarification. So your if you could explain your thoughts on what you've seen that makes you skeptical of the fact that these new, harsher laws will make a change to reduce the state's problem with these habitual DUI offenders.
Hannah, if you looked at all the states before Colorado, all the states that enacted a felony DUI, and you looked at their arrest records afterwards, you're going to find that none of those states had a decrease in DUI arrests because they increased the penalties and because they enacted a felony DUI. And Colorado has been no different. We've not seen a decrease in the last 2 years since the felony DUI became law. What does statistically make a difference is improving and focusing more on rehabilitation and treatment. And the statistics have shown through specialized DUI courts, drug courts, sobriety courts, things like that, that a person has a much less chance of reoffending with a sentence based on rehabilitation and treatment as opposed to incarceration. If you take someone and you incarcerate them and they lose their job, they lose their family, they lose pretty much everything they have, and then they walk out the door when that's all over, the likelihood is that they're going to remain sober is pretty slim. So while it would certainly be disingenuous for me or probably anyone else to say that there doesn't come a consequence with an offense like this on a repeated basis, what the legislature really is doing is only focusing on the punitive aspect of all this, and they never focus on the rehabilitative or treatment aspect of all this. And if we're going to spend money incarcerating people for repeat offenses, then the state really needs to look at spending that money instead on trying to work on the better treatment for first or second offenses so that we don't get to the third offense or the fourth offense.
And as you said, at KGNU and you as well, definitely recognize that DUI is a serious thing, and repeat DUI offenses as well puts people at risk, and that is no joking matter, and something very much to be taken seriously. But one thing that I thought was interesting about this as well is that we've spoken with you in the past about how DUI and DWAI limits in Colorado and elsewhere are pretty strict. Could you give those numbers for us again, explaining kind of what the legal limits are, just so we know what those are for both DUI and DWAI?
Absolutely. Hannah, it doesn't take much. And in our state, we don't have a .08 limit. We really have a .051 limit because Colorado has a driving while ability impaired law, which means that if you are impaired even to the slightest degree by alcohol, drugs, and that could be medical or recreational marijuana, that could be prescription medication that's legal, then that could be DWAI. And when you're counting prior offenses and current offenses, DWAI has with it really the same penalties that a DUI has, so you're not getting a whole big benefit from that. So we're not a .08 state, we're a .051 state. People have to remember that even when, you know, consuming one or two cocktails and thinking about getting behind the wheel of a car. It's just not a smart thing to do.
And that was criminal defense attorney Jay Tiftikjian speaking to us about Colorado's new felony DUI law for repeat offenders and DUI law in Colorado in general. Thank you so much for joining us on the program this morning, Jay.
Thank you, Hannah.
Stay tuned. And the time is 8:20. You're listening to KGNU. Lafayette teen Taylor Gleason is the co-founder of Students United Against Gun Violence and has just been honored for her work by a national foundation that recognizes the work of young people who are working to repair the world. She spoke with KGNU's Steve Miller.
It's an honor to have been selected as a Diller Teen Tikkun Olam Award recipient. The Diller Teen Tikkun Olam Awards are in their 11th year, and this year there were 15 winners, teenagers who started their own social justice project. There was an application process back in December. I was nominated by someone I worked with, and I found out in June, and I am so grateful to the Howard Diller Family Foundation for giving me this opportunity. It'll really impact a lot of things with my organization.
At what age were you when you started noticing the effects of gun violence in our society?
I think to some extent I've always been aware, just growing up as an elementary schooler in the post-Columbine era in Colorado. I remember drills, and I remember teachers being like, if there's a stranger in the building, this is what we do. And I had friends who had siblings who were at Columbine High School and whose parents had to live through that atrocities. But I think it was after the Aurora shooting in 2012 when it really resonated with me.
And was that when you said to yourself, well, I'm going to see what I can do to stop gun violence?
I think it was after really spending some time in the gun violence prevention community and learning what could be done on a legislative level to reduce the impacts of gun violence, and then seeing those things not happen, it made me really motivated and really passionate about doing anything I could to see those take place in the future. I started my work on gun violence prevention in the faith community. I served on the North American Board of the Reformed Jewish Youth Movement in my freshman year of university. And there I worked very closely on a gun violence prevention campaign. I learned a lot about what fighting gun violence looks like on a legislative level. I met a lot of incredible people who've devoted their lives to doing that. So when it came time for me and my co-founders to start Students United, we really had somewhat of an idea of who to talk to and where we wanted to go with this.
So right now you're a student at Ohio State University. And what are you studying?
I'm studying policy analysis and community organizing.
So did getting involved with the gun violence thing, did that have anything to do with what direction you chose as far as your studies?
Yes. I started off my studies in Washington, D.C. as an international studies major, and it was everything related to my gun violence prevention work that made me realize that I wasn't at the right school or studying the right thing. So I made that switch and started off at Ohio State.
What was the very first thing that your group, the Students United Against Gun Violence?
The Students United was founded right after the Orlando shooting in June of 2016. I think it was the anger, sadness, and heartbreak from that that was really resonating with a lot of students throughout the country. One of the first projects we took on was we were a co-sponsor of the Disarm Hate March in Washington, D.C. in August of 2016. It was about 20 or 30 different organizations dedicated to gun violence prevention. We were a partner in that and worked to bring a march to Washington, D.C. I think I've definitely moved from thinking that rallies were the only thing we could do to realizing that big change can happen on small levels. I think there's big power behind going to Washington, D.C. and making your voices heard in front of all your legislators, but there's also immense power behind being in the communities and speaking at town halls, reaching out to nonprofits and educating people and trying to make local legislation pass. There's almost more power on the small level than there is on the big, and that's something I've learned personally and those who I've worked with have learned as well.
And so what would you say to someone when you're talking about gun violence? You get into the talk of gun control, and when you talk about gun control, you're talking about people that sometimes think that you're going to take their guns away from them. How would you approach them?
I've been in multiple conversations with someone where we started off on the premise thinking that people fighting for gun violence prevention are trying to take away guns, when in fact that could not be further from the truth. One of the main legislative pieces that we really honed in on at the beginning was smart guns, which essentially make guns safer, things like touch identification. But never have we focused on anything trying to take away guns from all Americans. I think there are dozens of things that can be done on all levels, federal to local, to make guns safer. And it doesn't need to be by taking guns away from Americans.
How did you get involved with sponsoring the film, Is That a Gun in Your Pocket?
Reached out to us. It was really fun. As I mentioned, there's a lot of ways to go about fighting gun violence. And this movie came out in September of last year. And aside from a hilarious plot line, there were a lot of underlying messages about why gun safety is so important in everyday American households. It was really just a great opportunity to talk with people working on the issue in a different way and also show our team that there are plenty of ways to tackle gun violence prevention.
This is Steve Miller for KGNU.
And Steve was speaking with Taylor Gleason of Lafayette, who has just won the Diller Teen Tikkum Olam Award for her work as co-founder of Students Against Gun Violence. And now it's time for Tech Talks.
This is Tech Talks on KGNU with students from the Innovation Center at St. Vrain Valley Schools.
Estás escuchando Tech Talks con KGNU de parte de estudiantes del Innovation Center en las escuelas St. Vrain Valley.
This week on Tech Talks, we're going to discuss what makes a tablet, and what tablets are the best for the consumer market. A tablet is defined as a computing device that uses an on-screen interface and doesn't include a phone. While tablets have been around for years, the iPad was the first tablet to use the form factor successfully in the consumer market and really popularized the use of tablets. Tablets tend to use microprocessors rather than the bulky and heat-intensive central processing units of standard laptops. So tablets operate the touch function in one of two ways. The first way is with a resistance system that detects touch through pressure. This is more often used in tablets that are used for specifically art purposes and don't have the user interface actually visually on the screen. A capacity touch screen uses the electrical processes of your hand to change the electrostatic field of the screen. This is found in most mobile devices, such as phones and tablets, and it's becoming more and more popular. We're seeing the resistance systems falling to the wayside in favor of the capacity systems. They tend to be more durable as these screens can have a glass cover and aren't as prone to hardware malfunctions as resistance systems are.
There are many tablets out there to help students. Here are the best tablets to help prepare for back to school. The iPad Pro, Windows Surface Pro, and Amazon Fire HD 8 are some of the few tablets to help with schoolwork. The iPad Pro is a 10.5-inch ProMotion Retina display that has iOS 10 that can update to iOS 11. Once iOS 11 comes, the iPad Pro will be able to function like a laptop. The iPad Pro starts off with 4GB of RAM and 64GB of storage and offers higher options. The iPad Pro offers the best screen, best camera, and performance of all tablets. The iPad Pro offers more power than most PC laptops. A disadvantage about the iPad Pro is its price. The Windows Surface Pro is another great tablet to help out with schoolwork. It has a 12.3-inch display with a fanless Core M3 or Core i5U and fan-cooled Core i7U processors. The battery lasts up to 13.5 hours. This device is good if you enjoy having a tablet and laptop in one. A drawback for the Surface Pro is that it can't connect to a cellular network like the iPad Pro. The Amazon Fire HD 8 offers an 8-inch HD display with Type Prime integration. It comes with a 16GB storage and a micro SD. It's perfect if you want something not as fancy as the iPad Pro. This tablet is good for those on a budget. The cons of the device is that it isn't as powerful as an iPad Pro or Surface Pro and holds less storage.
Thanks for listening. We hope that this has been informative and helpful to your journey into becoming a pro tablet user. Right, right, right now is the best moment you ever know.
best moment you ever know.
You've been listening to Tech Talks on KGNU with students from the Innovation Center.
Una vez más, estuviste escuchando Tech Talks on KGNU con estudiantes del Innovation Center.
And that does it for The Morning Magazine. I've been your host, Hanley Myers. Now it's time for Connections with KGNU's Duncan Campbell. The topic this morning is Boulder's Democratic Community Control of Its Energy versus Xcel. We'll be inviting you to call in and join that conversation coming up in just a moment on Connections. Stay tuned.
This program is brought to you by the KGNU listener members and by Green Ride Boulder, the local company who offers timely shared ride transportation between Boulder area residents, businesses, and their convention hubs and Denver International Airport. More information at greenrideboulder.com.
This program is brought to you by Back to Basics Kitchen, a local meal service whose team makes dishes from scratch with local and organic ingredients. Back to Basics Kitchen features a new gluten-free menu every week with a variety of options for diets including paleo, vegetarian, and gaps-friendly. More information at backtobasicskitchen.com/KGNU.